RV Family Travel Atlas is sponsored by Jayco. Since 1968, Jayco has been providing a way for generations of families to create lasting memories. For more information, visit your local Jayco dealer or head over to jayco.com.
And by the Thetford Corporation. The industry expert and innovation leader, Thetford has made RV travel a more pleasant experience for over 50 years. To see a complete lineup of products, visit Thetford.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of RV Family Travel Atlas. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Jeremy.
And we write about RV and family travel with our three boys, Theo, Max, and Wes.
You can read about our adventures at RVFamilyTravelAtlas.com, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram.
On this week's episode of RV Family Travel Atlas, we interview the fascinating Al Hesselbart, author of the new book, RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History. The book is definitely fun-filled, and so is our chat with Al.
We talk about how the Elkhart, Indiana region became the RV capital of the world and all the quirky, interesting folks that shaped the industry over the years. Plus, Al gives us his take on recent consolidation and some predictions for the future.
You might think you know a little something about the history of the RV industry, but we know you haven't heard Al Hesselbart's stories yet. You are listening to episode number 163, The RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History with author Al Hesselbart.
Before we head into this week's featured topic, the RV capital of the world, a fun-filled Indiana history with author Al Hesselbart, it's time for our RV News Minute, which is all about tires.
Yeah, so it's amazing that we haven't talked about this yet on the show, right? But there's been a recent, we think, quite a big development in the world of RV tires.
Absolutely big. I mean, it's a running joke among RV owners that tires are China bombs. That,
right.
You know, we have these, all have these tires that are cheap and they're made in China, and there's, the running joke is not if you're going to have a blowout, but when you're going to have a blowout. And RV owners almost look at it as inevitable that they will. But now Goodyear has stepped back into the game, and they are making really good, high-quality tires right here in America. And manufacturers like Jayco are including them on every product they sell, and we are really excited.
Yeah, so, you know, we've focused in the past mainly on what you can do to prevent a blowout by your own behavior, right? We've said, okay, a lot of people blame the China bombs, but there's also the issue of appropriate tire pressure and appropriate tire maintenance and all these things we can do to make our RV tires, you
know,
last longer.
Not overloading the
RV. Exactly.
Checking the tire pressure on every traveling day. But how about also just buying better tires?
Exactly. So, but the quality does really matter. So last year, this Goodyear actually released a brand new tire. It's their Endurance line of tires, and they're produced in Akron, Ohio. So one of the things that really separates this tire from any other RV tire available is it's manufactured in the USA. And RV Business recently did a short interview, just, you know, maybe five questions or so, with Doug Grassian, who is the director of North American Consumer Communications for Goodyear. All right. And he just kind of talked about why Goodyear produce these tires and a little bit about what makes them different. So it's interesting, and I'll link to the RV Business article in our show notes if you want to read the whole thing.
Look, for me, to be honest with you, the fact that they're made in America is reason enough to buy them if they were a comparable tire. But what we are hearing from within the industry is that they are a superior tire. And actually, we just had four of them shipped to our house, and
yeah,
we are going to swap out our tires. I'll probably wait to the spring at this point because the RV is about to get winterized fairly soon. But I got the Goodyear Endurance tire, and I'm really super excited to put them on for next traveling season.
Right now, these tires are coming standard on Jayco's, and also Airstream and Lance campers
are using them.
Quality.
Right. I mean, those are three brand names in the industry that are known for quality. And if they're using the Goodyear tires, that makes me feel pretty good about them.
All right. So I want to read what Grassian said is different about the Endurance tire than other tires. So he says, Endurance has a new ground-up design incorporating the latest mold and cavity technology, as well as compound technology. Now, you know as well as I do what that means. But anyway, he's saying it. So he also goes on to say some of the features include Goodyear's patented DuraWall technology, which helps prevent cuts and punctures to the sidewalls, a specialized inner liner that minimizes air loss because of its construction with 100% halobutyl rubber, and a new
It's all about the halobutyl.
Halobutyl. Some chemist out there is listening right now.
That's the secret. I can't believe they just came out and said it in the interview.
And a new decoupling groove in the thread design, allowing the tires to remain cool while towing heavy loads. So right there, you see all these different facets that a RV owner is going to be concerned about.
Look, I know the pickup truck owner really likes Goodyear tires, and they're considered an elite tire up there with maybe Michelin tires. And I've always really liked Goodyear tires. I had them on the Silverado. Don't have them on the F-250 now. I would like to get them on the F-250, frankly, but I don't have a good excuse to go out and spend that cash at the moment. But I'm excited that Goodyear's re-entered the RV industry with this endurance tire line. Now, if you want to get them for your RV, good luck, because I think that they're really having a hard time producing enough right now. I mean, your best bet is to go buy a new RV that has them on there, but you could call your dealer and see if there's something you could order.
Right, because he says that right now they're outpacing what they were expecting to with performance and sales on these. So they're really feeling the success with it. And actually, I think it seemed, if you read between the lines of this interview, it seemed like he's saying they're looking to expand their offerings.
You didn't have to read too hard between the lines. Yeah.
All right. So anyway, I'll link to this article from RVBusiness.com if you want to kind of get a little more information, if you want to do your own research on this. But we really feel that this is incredibly good news for the RV consumer. And we also feel like it, relates to what we're saying, that, if we are spending money on certain things as RV consumers, that the industry will respond to that. Just like if you're not willing to spend money on things in the RVs, then you're probably going to get cheaper and cheaper products. But when there's demand out there, Goodyear said, we heard that there was a demand for this from our consumers, so we decided to meet it. So,
yeah. Now, listen, we have a great interview coming up. I'm thrilled with this interview. It was fascinating. With a gentleman named Al Hesselbart, who really is the premier RV historian in America today. And he's the author of two books, which are both fascinating. The first one is The Dumb Thing Sold Just Like That. And his brand new book is The RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History. And we are going to dive into a lengthy conversation with Al about all the quirky characters that gave birth to this industry that we love so much. So stay tuned for a great interview with Al Hesselbart. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We are incredibly excited to be here with everybody's favorite RV historian, Al Hesselbart, who is the author of The Dumb Thing Sold Just Like That and the brand new book, The RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History. And we're going to dive into a great conversation with him. But first, we have a sponsored message from our friends at Thetford.
The industry expert and innovation leader, Thetford has made RV travel a more pleasant experience for over 50 years, and they have also been helping RV owners to keep their RVs in tip-top condition. This time of year, you're going to see a lot of tips out there for RV maintenance. Remember that Thetford has a complete lineup of time-tested products, including drain valve, lubricant, toilet seal, and holding tank cleaners. To find out more about each of these products and if your RV could benefit from them, check out the informational videos linked in the show notes or see a complete lineup of products at Thetford.com.
A big welcome to the show to you, Al. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us today.
Hi, Al.
I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, we are very excited to have purchased your new book, The RV Capital of the World, and we both read that and enjoyed it and learned so much. So now we're going to quiz you and talk to you and help you educate our audience. So let's get started back in the 1930s. So why did the travel trailer industry begin to concentrate in Elkhart and South Bend in that region of northern Indiana? What was it about that part of the world?
Well, it had started 20 years earlier in various locations around the country, upstate New York and Southern California being two. But in the midst of the Depression in the early 1930s, there was a World's Fair or Grand Exposition in Chicago, the Chicago World's Fair of 1932-33. Several young men from Elkhart visited that fair, and as the sons of Elkhart businessmen, they fell in love with what was designated to be the best exhibit at that fair. And that was an exhibit put on by the infant travel trailer business. And so three young men came back to Elkhart in the early 30s and began an involvement in the RV industry. As it turned out, all three of them were really genius RV innovators. As told in the book, Milo Miller, a house painter, was basically out of work because of the Depression, and he invented a product that he called Auto Top Rejuvenator. Cars of the late 20s and early 30s mostly had a canvas panel in the roof that had to be dressed a couple times a year. And Milo invented a dressing to dress it and took off to various big factories where he applied his dressing. Well, to take his family along, he home-built a travel trailer that turned to be so well-functional that before the third day of his first trip with that travel trailer, people were throwing money at him to buy it. And on the fourth day out, he sold his family's travel trailer at a factory in Midland, Michigan, which at that time was a two-day drive from the Elkhart South Bend area, and left them homeless 2 days away from home.
Nice dad there, huh?
He immediately went to a local junkyard where he had obtained most of the parts for the first trailer and bought a junk auto frame, some skin, a few automobile windows, and assembled his second homemade travel trailer. Well, during the week that he was at Midland, Michigan, the second one sold, and at prices that he could not refuse. So he returned, actually, to Mishawaka, Indiana at that time, and says, I can make more money building trailers than I can painting houses, especially when nobody wants their house painted. And so he set up shop. He paid rent for an open shed in a lumber yard where he was able to get consignment materials to start building trailers, and they advanced him funds one trailer at a time when he started building trailers. But before the first year was out, he had moved it to a closed blacksmith shop in Elkhart and was producing trailers in what became the first trailer factory in Elkhart, Indiana.
So he was a scrappy, hardworking, ingenious Midwesterner.
He was. And I had the pleasure in writing The Dumb Thing Sold to sit down for several hours with Milo Miller's two sons, the older of whom had actually worked with him in the factory. So I got a whole lot of detail on the first trailer factory in Elkhart and what went on.
Now, Al, did the two sons tell the story about how it felt to have their father sell their home out from under their feet a couple of times on that first journey? Or did the memory of that sort of fade away with the expansion of their business?
Well, as his son Glenn described, his two sons that I talked to were Glenn, the older one, and Charles, the younger one. And as Glenn decided, the kids and mom were none too happy of not knowing where we're going to sleep tonight.
I love it.
But as the business quickly turned successful and profitable, that moment of upset quickly disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Now, Al, this is what I love about your book, is it's filled with these quirky characters from the Midwest, these hardworking, scrappy, creative guys. And there's dozens of them we could talk to. We're not going to get to talk about all of them. But could you talk to us about Edward Habig, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, of Indianapolis?
Yeah, I believe it's pronounced Habig, but...
Well, I'm going to go with what you say, because you're the RVist. I'm going to trust you.
I never met him since he died in the 1920s or something. But Edward Habig built in Indianapolis a folding tent camper-type trailer, which did successfully sell in about 1915, and is recognized as the first commercially produced RV in Indiana.
Now, they weren't cheap at that time. These were not built for the working man, were they?
No, they weren't cheap when you realize that the working man was working for about 5 cents an hour, which in an eight-hour day, that gave him $4. Gave him 40 cents in a day. They sold for $168, which was half a year's salary.
So this was a product for the upper class at the time. At least this one was.
Most of the pre-war RV models completely were targeted to, I guess in the terms of many of us working stiffs, were targeted at the idle rich.
Now, you point out that's pre-war. So how does World War II change the whole game?
World War II and innovations by the military and innovations by U.S. industry changed the buying power of the American public. In 1945, 46, 47, several million Americans returned to their homes. Most were young men in their early 20s. They got married, began raising families, and looked for affordable recreation for their families. And camping became one of the primary sources of that affordable recreation, because by now being 1950-ish, automobiles had developed enough power that they could pull a trailer. And so trailering became a popular affordable recreation for the World War II veteran families, and the industry simply exploded to fill demand.
Well, that industry exploded. And then you also talk about how that trailer industry really gave birth to a lot of other industries out there. You want to talk to us a little bit more about how, you know, there was like the sort of domino effect within the U.S. economy?
Yeah, it was two parallel stepladders, I guess is the way I try to describe it. As more and more people started building trailers, those people needed more and more supplies. And so the supplier industry, those companies that warehoused plywood and lumber and furniture and floor coverings and stoves, refrigerators, furnaces, all discovered that, well, we need to go to Elkhart because that's where the trailers are being made, and they need our stuff, and we can ship it across town a whole lot cheaper than we could ship it across country. And so as more suppliers built warehouses and factories in Elkhart, more people decided to start factories. And so they just took turns taking steps up the ladder.
And all of this, assumably, makes the RVs more affordable. Economies of scale, right? Makes it more of a product for the working class. Would you say that's true?
Yes, very much so. It was into the late 50s before basic travel trailers exceeded $500 or $600 in cost. Now, there were larger trailers, which ended up turning into mobile homes, but the basic travel trailer and the tent trailers were sold for $400 or $500. And so a man with a decent job could afford them.
Now, previously, I have to back up one second because I just something I want to get in here. I'm fascinated by this transition from the early trailers being for the wealthy to them becoming for the common man. Now, backing up a little bit, a lot of the early trailers were advertised in places like Billboard and Variety magazines for celebrities, no?
Well, not necessarily for celebrities. That was the primary source of Elkhart's largest early pioneer, who was Wilbur Schult. Wilbur Schult found an audience in the entertainment and carnival industry. The vaudevillians, the stage actors who traveled, the carnival people who traveled. And that was the target of the Variety and Billboard ads, not the stars.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting to me that now it seems to be circling back around to more of that full-time RV consumer. So you're saying it started out being marketed as sort of the person who works from the road. And then it seems like it took a little bit of a transition into more recreation. And now if you look at a lot of RV sort of culture, they say that there's growth in the full-time RVing market, people that work maybe in different transient jobs or that aren't connected to an actual sticks and bricks office. They're taking up the RV lifestyle more and more. So to me, all of a sudden, I saw a sort of circular, you know, relationship there between the early industry and the present one.
That's absolutely true. The biggest thing that has promoted that is that a majority of the RVs, and this is changing today some, but a majority of the RVs are no longer little two- or three-person campers. They're no longer a tin tent that you could go camp for a weekend in and take home and store. They have become what the early mobile housing industry, they, by and large, are mobile homes, mobile domiciles. When you jump in a 40-foot fifth wheel or a 45-foot diesel pusher, that's larger than a family home in half of the countries in the world.
That's a great point.
And so the availability of comfortable lifestyle over wheels has made today's full-time or most-time living arrangement very, very doable.
Great. Let's talk now about the Trailer Coach Manufacturers Association. This particularly fascinated me to see that the trailer industry decided to collaborate and work together on their marketing, which is, I think, very unique among American industries. Can you give us a little bit of the history on the TCMA?
Well, TCMA was the second generation. It became a way for the various manufacturers to band together mainly for marketing their product. And then through some government encouragement to standardize and create standards for quality of their products. And the early pioneers, I'm talking in the 30s now, who were genius enough to recognize that they were the midwives, as it were, at the birth of an entire new industry for the country. And they were, while very, very strong competitors, also close enough together that they shared their secrets to try to jointly improve the products and their industry.
So
it was quite remarkable to read how different manufacturers, they'd go to a show and cut each other's throat and do whatever it could to sell the products. And then they'd come home and go out to drink and decide, this worked well for me, what worked well for you? There was no such thought in those early days of industrial espionage. We didn't think it was a negative thing to go into a competitor's factory, see what he was doing, and go home and duplicate it. That was a standardly acceptable behavior, not espionage.
It seemed like smart business.
it was. One of the early pioneers, Wilbur Schultz, who started business as a retail dealer in Elkhart after the Chicago World's Fair, determined that his supplier, a company called Covered Wagon out of Detroit, was making better profit on his work that he was selling them. So he decided that he was going to build them. So what did he do? He went and got the two most popular models, the little one and the bigger one, dismantled them piece by piece, and built jigs to recreate those, dropped his franchise with them, and began making exact duplicates of their products, and did it successfully, and his company still exists.
Well, you know, honestly, hearing that, it kind of puts a lot of puzzle pieces together in the sense that a lot of people nowadays say, oh, everything within the RV industry is just copy and paste, right? This floor plan, that floor plan. But it sounds like there was a very healthy history of that from the very beginning, of that being sort of the way that people were looking at what worked, what was selling, what was making money, and just kind of turning around and doing their version of it right out their front door in Indiana. So that's very interesting for me, not having known that history. But Al Hassebart, that was a great first segment on just sort of the history of the RV industry in Indiana. We're going to talk more about this, so everybody stay tuned.
Look forward to it.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We are really excited to be here with Al Hesselbart, everybody's favorite RV historian and the author of The Dumb Things Sold Just Like That and the brand new book, RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History. And we're going to talk a lot more about that history with Al in a second. But first, we have a sponsored message from our friends at Jayco.
The North Point Luxury Fifth Wheel is an impressive blend of features that will make for a camping experience that is something for everyone. Backed by Jayco's 2-year limited warranty, the North Point is the perfect choice for those seeking a chance to escape it all. Visit your local Jayco dealer or jayco.com for more information. Jayco, generations of family fun.
Welcome back to the show, Al. We certainly hope you're still there.
I am here.
All right, great.
Oh, good. And I bet you have more stories to tell us.
There are so many. Honestly, we could interview you for 3 hours. I want to dive back into some of the quirky stories and the quirky personalities that kind of form the backbone of your new book. So could you tell us a little bit about the Continental Clipper? That really stood out as an interesting section of the book.
It really is an interesting story. The Continental Clipper was a very, very early fifth wheel contraption that was a totally custom-made, not production model unit, built for a Boston area publisher by the Schultz Trailer Company in Elkhart. It was an amazing vehicle, which included a custom-made truck or tractor to pull it, which included a semi-sleeper on the back of the pulling tractor, because it was totally designed to be chauffeur-driven. And the family traveled in the over-hitch compartment where most fifth wheels today have a bedroom, and it had a couch up there and windows out the front that included windshield wipers on a fifth wheel trailer where they could sit and watch the world go by. And it was luxurious beyond almost anybody's home. It had a full stainless steel restaurant-style kitchen. It had a black ceramic-tiled bathroom. It had a telephone, which could be plugged into a telephone wire wherever they stopped and have telephone access. It was quite a remarkable vehicle, and it appeared to have a front and back door, as many of the large fifth wheels do today. But on further examination, you discovered that the back door, which would go into the lounge area in many fifth wheels of today's design, went into the maid's quarters and was a private quarters for the maid. And so since it was built in the mid-50s, we have lost a whole lot of class in our RVing style. There's not very many of us that RV with a chauffeur and a maid with us full time.
I bet you if they sold it today, people would buy it.
I'm missing out.
And you know what? They act like these new front living room fifth wheels with the big windows are brand new, but apparently not.
No, there has been nothing new added to the RV design other than size and fancier appliances since the early 50s. Now, the ending of the Continental Clipper story is somewhat amazing. After traveling in it from 1938 till about 1946, Mr. Ginoble had traveled the entire country for 7 years in it and had become bored with it. And so he put it for sale and sold it to King Farouk of Egypt. And it was shipped to Egypt, where Farouk put a couple of chairs on the roof and took it down into Africa for lion hunting expeditions. Okay. He then is known to have sold it to the Sultan of Peshawar in India. We know that sale happened, but there is no record of it ever arriving in India, and no record known of was it stolen? Did the ship carrying it around the Horn sink? Nobody knows what happens, but the sale is documented.
Al, we'd like you to dig into that a little bit more, because I think there's a whole book in this story.
Maybe scuba dive
There actually is a book on the Continental Clipper that Mr. Ginoble wrote after his experiences with it, which is no longer in print, of course, but is available in some rare book things as the 24-carat trailer. That's the title of the book.
Oh, well, now Jeremy has his next book that it's on his reading list. All right, let's jump a little bit ahead to the 1970s, which were sort of a difficult time for the RV industry and, you know, definitely had an impact on the future development of the industry. Do you want to dive in to just a little bit about how that decade shaped the future?
Yeah, the 1970s was probably a crisis in the entire national RV industry that exceeds anything we've seen since. In 72, the first Arab oil embargo, which shut down gas stations and brought fuel lines and all manner of crises, just about shut down the industry. As in the late 70s, 77, 78, the industry began to claw their way up out of losing over 50% of the companies going bankrupt. Along came the 78, 79 Arab oil embargo, where they didn't cut us off, they just doubled the price of everything. And about again took out. So from there being someplace between 300 and 400 companies manufacturing RVs of all kinds in 1969 and 70, by 1980 and 81, there were less than 150. So we're talking two-thirds of the industry was totally destroyed and was just barely hanging on by their fingernails. And then through the 80s, because during that period of relative inactivity, all kinds of modern conveniences came into use. That's when microwaves appeared. That's when all kinds of things, appliances of the size that could be stuck in a trailer, came into being. And the 80s and early 90s trailers were just overwhelmingly popular. Number one, from people who had been camping, there was a tremendous pent-up demand, and people would buy anything on any sales lot. But the fact that automobiles improved in power and size again as they did post-war, pickup trucks became acceptable family transportation and not something that said you were a poor dirt farmer, which had been the 50s story, and we got the ability to go from 15 and 16 foot trailers to 28 and 30 foot trailers filled with all kinds of appliances and then TVs. My story says it's what happens when all of a sudden they're filled with the things we tried to escape for the first 50 years of RVs.
That's great. That's a great line. So you did a great job of kind of bringing us into the modern RV industry, and that's what we wanted to talk about next. So let's talk about a couple of the major figures and major companies today. So could you tell us a little bit about Peter Legal and the role that he has played in the RV industry and consolidation in the RV industry with his work at Forest River?
Pete Legal, who I know, is one of the modern geniuses. Between he and Wade Thompson, who built Thor, they were amazing, and Pete still is an amazing guy. Pete started in the industry as a plant manager type guy for Coachman. And because he had such great ideas and decided to do things his way and not the company way, ended up getting fired by Coachman. And he went off and bought into and got a company called Cobra, which was an early 80s manufacturer. And then some things hit economically, and it was in trouble. And he sold Cobra lock, stock, and barrel to an investment outfit from New England. And then he recognized that I know how to save this company, and these guys are just destroying it. So as they went bankrupt with Cobra, he bought the brand names and real estate, but not the names and stuff, not the company name back, changed the name of the company, still making the same brand trailers as before, and created Forest River. And hit it right on the head. Forest River began growing very well, and at a time in the early 2000s, a man known to all began interest in the RV and trailer industry, a gentleman by the name of Warren Buffett. And Pete approached Warren Buffett and asked if he might like to own an RV company named Forest River. And after some investigation, Warren made an offer to Pete Legal to buy Forest River and employ Pete as its leader and head and still pay him a full salary after having given him $1 billion dollars for his company.
And it ended up being a pretty good bet for Warren Buffett, right?
And that turned out to be a good bet for, well, Warren Buffett hasn't made very many bad bets.
Not that we know about, at least.
not that are publicized. But Warren took over the financial ownership of Forest River. And then because of we peons, an unlimited supply of money, began finding other quality companies that were in various stands of trouble and adding to them till the biggest purchase he got at that time when he started doing that. Four companies were the biggest companies in the industry, and they were Forest River, Thor, Winnebago, and Coachman. Well, Coachman got in some financial problems, And so the number two company in the industry, Forest River at that time, bought the number three company in the industry and became the number one company in the industry. And still more acquisitions of some startups and some companies in trouble have got Forest River right up in the top. Well, Thor continued to grow, and Thor Industries, which is not named for a Greek god, but Thor is the first two letters of its founder, Wade Thompson's last name, and his partner, Peter Orthwine. And so it's T-H and O-R to become Thor. And they started growing like crazy. And finally, they found that now there are three big companies in the industry, and it's Forest River, Thor, and Jayco. So they bought Jayco, going around Forest River and becoming the biggest company. So it's that stepladder thing again. He with the money wins. It's the businessman's golden rule. He with the most gold rules.
Now, also, though, after reading your book, one thing I really kind of felt like I learned was that consolidation almost seems inevitable in such a turbulent industry, and in an industry that's so impacted by recession. It almost seems like it's the only way to go for the smaller company to be bought by the larger company. It's almost seems like a survival mechanism to me, if anything. I mean, would you agree with that? Would you say that consolidation has just the inevitable course?
To a degree, I would very much agree with that. The innovator, the new entrepreneur who is trying to enter the RV industry, in many cases, operates his entire business on credit. He does not have a financial footing to be able to survive anything but the smallest crisis. And so when things happen, in order to keep his company alive, he must find an influx of funds, which most often is acquired by selling his company to one of the alligators that's out there trying to eat him up. Now, there are a few people who have weathered those storms and grown dramatically. Tiffin being one. Bob Tiffin has managed to keep his company independent through many of these trials. And Winnebago is another who both started from scratch, basically started in somebody's basement and grew up. So, yeah, but for the most part, the guy with a good idea and nice design and going, and the last of my book, the last of RV Capital, tells the story of three industry geniuses who left Thor, started up a dynamic company that grew by leaps and bounds, called Grand Design, built some of the finest fifth wheels in the country. And the time got right, and they sold out to Winnebago and became part of the towable, the new towable division of Winnebago.
Do you see Winnebago becoming one of the big three and maybe one day equaling Forest River and Thor? Or do you think it's past that point and Forest River and Thor really will be the dominant players for many years to come?
I think the pie has limited size. And the two biggest slices of the pie have been eaten. I don't think there's enough pie left, even by acquiring very successful companies that Winnebago can join their outlandish size. Now that's, and Winnebago is by far the oldest of the big three now, and that is the big three. Since Coachman and Jayco are both part of those combines, and Winnebago's been around in Forest City, Iowa since 1958. They're the oldest. They are strong. They've operated on a limited credit basis for all these 60 years. And I think there'll always be a successful company. I think they'll be, in today's world, a middle-sized company and not one of the two giants or three giants. And opening, they're the one of those companies that I own stock in.
Thank you for the complete disclosure. Now, Al, I could honestly talk to you all day, but we're going to wrap it up. I have one last question for you. Now, you have written about so many of these classic RVs, and we know you played a major role in the RV Hall of Fame over the years. If you could have any of the classic RVs you've written about in mint condition, like it rolled right off the line just for you, what RV would you want to have?
Hard question to answer, and there the answer is two different ones, one of which I own and live in. I have a Newell, probably without question the finest Class A motorhome ever built, and still today the finest Class A motorhome ever built. And by far the most expensive Class A motorhome. That is not a converted bus, but is a Class A motorhome. A Newell coach today will cost in the neighborhood of $1.8 million base price. That's partially why I live in a 40-year-old version thereof.
Al, do we have picture evidence of this? Can you send us a picture?
We would actually love a picture.
Sure. And unlike many full-time RVers, my full-time RV is not turned into a park model. I do travel with it. I go to FMCA rallies. I did almost 7,000 miles, not this immediate last summer, but the summer before that. So my 40-year-old coach does travel up and down the highway. And I said quickly that there were two models. The second one of the classics that I would love to have and was what I was looking for when I found my Newell would be a early classic Teton home, which was in its day the finest fifth wheel money could make, and they were made in Casper, Wyoming.
Well, Al, thank you so much. That was a fascinating conversation, and we really hope to have you back on the show one day. Again, for our listeners, that was Al Hesselbart. He's the author of The Dumb Things Sold Just Like That and his brand new book, RV Capital of the World, A Fun-Filled Indiana History. Both are available wherever books are sold.
And we will have links to both of those books in the show notes for this episode over on RVFamilyTravelAtlas.com, so you can link right through and get your own copies of these great books.
Al, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks, Jeremy.
All right, we'll talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. That was just a really terrific, interesting, in-depth interview with Al Hesselbart. And it's one of the reasons I love doing a podcast is we can actually do like a 40-minute interview with somebody and go in-depth on a topic. And we know a lot of you RV geeks out there love that kind of interview, too.
Well, let's face it. Every single one of those questions, Al really could have done a complete podcast episode on, right?
And I think we're going to have them back. Now, listen, we're so excited about this interview. We're going to give away two copies of Al's new book. In fact, I mean, Al is going to give away two copies of his new book, and he's going to sign them for whoever wins. So we have two different ways you could win a copy of RV Capital of the World. The first one is we definitely want our podcast listeners to have a chance, and particularly for those of you who are not really on social media, because we do so many of the giveaways on social media. So if you want to win Al's book, send us an email at rvfamilytravelatlas@gmail.com and just say, I want to win Al's book, and we'll enter you.
This is our nod to all of you folks out there who don't want to be on social media.
And good
media.
For you.
It's okay.
Frankly, good for you. So just shoot us that email, say, I want Al's book, and we'll randomly pick
you're
one of those.
You're still reading
emails.
Books because you're not on social media.
Yeah, you actually are the people who read books. And then for the social media freaks, we'll give away one on Instagram. We'll put up a picture of it, and we'll give you some basic instructions, and we'll randomly pick one winner from Instagram as well. And Al is going to sign these books and send them directly to you, and it really is a great read.
All right. Now, another thing that I wanted to mention in the RV FTA News Roundup is that we have another article in the most recent, is October edition of the Trailer Life magazine. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is it's on campground etiquette, which is a topic that obviously has been covered a lot. We've talked about it before. But Trailer Life asked us to do the article. And I feel like we really said to Trailer Life, hey, we'll do this, but we're going to do it from sort of the RVFTA perspective on this, right? Like, which is kind of campground etiquette stems from everybody being happy campers and not being cranky campers, right? Like if we start there and we work forward and we talk about positive things you can do at the campground, we think that everybody is happier.
And not going and looking for problems at the campground, because guess what? If that's your attitude, you're going to find them. It doesn't matter how good the campground is. And I have to say, this is my favorite article we have done for Trailer Life, and we've done a whole batch of them in the last 2 years. This is my absolute favorite. I mean, as a reader, I enjoyed reading this and kind of revisiting all of the ideas. And I think that's a really useful, helpful article. And I also love the photo selection.
So I just wanted to say, in addition to that, that I felt like Trailer Life was really open to our perspective, and they have been. So I've seen a little bit of an editorial shift over at Trailer Life, and I would say the last 7 months or so, where
they have a new editor.
I'm going to just come out and say it. I'm a woman. And I'm telling you, I feel like the magazine has become a little more woman friendly. Now, I know that that's a huge over, you know.
But I know exactly what you mean. And I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm speaking for you, I just feel like it was very tech heavy and very tips and trick gear heavy. And I love the editorial direction of Trailer Life right now. It is more general interest. It is more up to speed and of the moment.
There's Q&As with readers. Like, there's more of that sort of question, answer, guidance, education. And then also the new product recommendations to me are more lifestyle oriented, not all gear and tech. Like, there was just a difference as I was reading the, you know, I would say the last 5 issues or so. So I wanted to tell any of our listeners out there that maybe haven't picked up Trailer Life in a little while, I would recommend trying it again, because I get why you may have put it down in the past, but I do think they're making an effort to incorporate more voices. I mean, look, they're constantly
and the
giving us assignments.
The tech is still there. It's just, it is more of a general interest read on all things RVing, and they're embracing some younger voices like our own.
Yeah, so I'm happy that they're doing that. And I kind of feel like, even though, of course, we're a little biased because they're asking us for more and more articles, and we're writing for them more. I think that that is a sign of that editorial shift. So check it out again if you haven't.
Absolutely. And if you just want to sample it, it is available on the newsstand. You can find it at Barnes & Noble most of the time. So give Trailer Life a shot. I've been reading it cover to cover every issue.
All right. A big thank you to our sponsor to this episode, Jayco.com, to see a complete lineup of all of their 2018 trailers, right?
And also to Thetford, and you can head on over to Thetford.com to check out all their great products that make RVing a more pleasurable experience for all of us. And hopefully we'll see all of you one day at the RV Hall of Fame in Elkhart, Indiana.
All right, see you at the campground.